Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
We're beginning with a high school shooting in Great Mills, Maryland. The sheriff's department in the town has responded to reports of gunfire and the school is in lockdown. CNN's research department reports that there have been 16 confirmed school shootings since January 1st, the most deadly, of course, being the school shooting in Parkland, Florida on February 14th. We're wondering if these shootings occur in clusters and are in some ways inspired by the news coverage of the events. So we're turning to Robert Spitzer for some insight on that. He's the chair of political science department at the State University of New York at Cortland and the author of Guns Across America. He's with us from Cortland, New York. And Robert, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you.
Yes, hello. Good to be with you.
School shootings, of course, a fact of life in the United States. When you pull back, do you see a pattern? Do you see clusters where they occur on a timeline that's somewhat close to one another?
I'm not sure that there is a decisive pattern that clusters such incidents in a way that would be readily apparent. It's important to remember, of course, that while we do have these shootings, there are also a great many shootings or other attacks that are thwarted, that are caught before the person does the bad thing. And theoretically, those should be counted as part of the if you're going to graph these out and see if they cluster together, it would be important to include that kind of information, too. I don't know if that kind of research exists, but I don't know of any obvious pattern that's been reported. However, we do know that many of these shooters do, if you will, go to school on past shootings. When you investigate the information that these perpetrators have gathered, and you know it's studied by police and investigators after the fact, it's not uncommon to find that they've gathered news clippings or information through the internet about past mass shootings and mass shooters. So there is a certain kind of copycat period, or copycat pattern rather. It doesn't mean that they would not have committed the crimes had there not been past shootings. These are, after all, people who are bent on doing something terrible, and it's hard. I don't think there's an argument that sort of nothing would have happened if there had been no past shootings, but there is definitely a kind of pattern where these people do gather information about past similar incidents.
Yeah, let me ask you about, it's interesting to hear you use the phrase go to school on this in some ways, because I wonder, are they just, is it more a reinforcement of the idea that there is notoriety around, you know, pulling off one of these school shootings? Or do you think they're actually gathering, for lack of a better phrase, operational details, right? This is how to get into a school. These are the weapons that I can get, those kinds of things.
Well, I think there's reason to believe that it's both of those things. Some are certainly attracted to the notoriety. Others have, you know, some of these shooters in the past have commented on how they want to be famous and how they want their names to be sort of immortalized along with the names of other past shooters. And there are, that could or could not overlap with some of these people gathering information about technical matters relating to how they carried out these kinds of attacks. So there is information about both of these kinds of things. Not that every shooter does both of these things, mm-hmm. but that information certainly is a part of the pattern that that attributes itself to these attackers.
I've wondered if you think the student activism that has resulted from Parkland, of course, that's propelled news coverage, but it is also clear that the student activists are in state capitals planning a big march on Washington. Whether, as you observe that, whether that may be at all a factor of maybe some of these increased incidents. Again, hearing what you're saying about no clear evidence that there are patterns here.
Well, it's hard to imagine that, I mean, nothing is beyond bounds, theoretically at least, but it's hard to imagine that somebody would be inspired by virtue of the fact that there's going to be a demonstration against gun violence or that there have been past demonstrations, because there are people who seem to be attracted to the idea of gun violence, not to the idea of trying to thwart gun violence. And it's hard for me to imagine that there would be any kind of direct connection between those sorts of things. There certainly were, and it was reported in the news, I think, within the first couple weeks after the Parkland shooting in February, that there were several incidents of people who were planning attacks but who were caught by various means. And that goes to the copycat idea. But it's hard to believe that the protest, including the one this Saturday in Washington, D.C., would be a direct contributor to new attacks.
Robert Spitzer is with us if you've just tuned in. He's chair of the political science department at SUNY Cortland and author of Guns Across America. And we're talking to him this morning on the news of the school shooting in Maryland. Not a lot of details about what has happened there, but reports of gunfire inside the school, and it is locked down. We'll have more coverage of that for you later this afternoon. Talking to Robert, though, this morning about whether the news coverage, the details that come out about the school shooting inspire other would-be shooters. I also want to talk to him this morning about the politics of this. That is also his specialty, where our history of guns in America meets our political framework. If you have questions about that, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. That's something that you write about in your book, Robert, Guns Across America, about understanding how our history of guns in the United States meets our political framework. Fast forward that, what you were writing about in the book, to where we are today with this activism that I mentioned, with these debates that are going on in state capitals, and with the debate that isn't going on in Congress. What do you observe about that?
Well, and there, in our past, there has been a direct connection between serious incidents of either assassinations or gun violence or crime-related violence that has correlated with the enactment of new stricter gun laws. Way back in 1934, for example, the first modern significant national gun law called the National Firearms Act was passed in 1934, largely in response to the rise of gangland violence and the use of very destructive weapons like the Tommy gun and sawed-off shotguns and gun silencers. And so we had legislation that resulted. Similar legislative action occurred in 1968 and in the early 1990s, also after shootings. And so those historically have been related to each other. What we found in the last couple decades, though, is that it's been harder and harder, or there's been more resistance to the idea of looking at or enacting tougher gun laws after similar incidents. Those efforts at the national level have largely failed, as was the case, for example, after the shooting in Littleton, Colorado in April of 1999, when Congress considered new legislation, significant legislation, but it ultimately failed, as was true after Sandy Hook in 2012, when President Obama made some proposals to Congress in the spring of 2013. So it's been harder to kind of get things done, to get a real look at the nation's gun laws and what, if anything, should be done to change them in recent years.
A quick question here before we take a call. And do you sense that that student activism is changing that dynamic that you've just described when it comes to politics of it?
Well, I think it has, and it has already, even though it consider it fairly short term. And the evidence of that was the bill that the Florida State Legislature passed a couple of weeks ago that was in direct response to the student protests. And it's hard to imagine that that legislation would have been enacted had it not been for the students. So that, I think, by itself is kind of a remarkable accomplishment. The big question for them is whether the students and their supporters will be able to sustain that activism between now and looking ahead to the fall November midterm elections.
A call here from Vance in Aiken, Minnesota. Hi, Vance. Your question on this.
Oh, I just noticed that there's been controversy about like hardening the schools, but I've noticed in real high violence areas like Chicago, New York, and some places in California, where they have hardened, you know, they have metal detectors, and they know that armed police are on site. They don't seem to have shootings there.
Robert, any kind of evidence or pattern to the schools that these would-be shooters may be choosing, depending on the kind of security infrastructure that they have?
Well, it doesn't seem as though they make a decision on where to go based on how well protected a school is per se, because the shooters tend to be people who have attended the schools where they're doing the shooting, or it's a school right in their geographical proximity. And that does not suggest that they're sort of looking at a map and trying to identify a school that has fewer protections than others. Obviously, it's important to point out that there have been many steps taken at public schools all across the country in the last 15, 18, 20 years to improve security, not just lockdown drills, but also locking more doors, having resource officers. And we need to remind ourselves that even though these shootings are terrible and, you know, school children being injured and killed, that we've had less than a dozen school children die from gunshots annually for most of the last 8 or 10 years or so. And there are 50 million school children in public schools today. So in 2015-16, for example, 6 school children were killed with guns. So, you know, we're not talking about a massive crime wave that's sweeping through public schools.
So, Robert, is all that to say, if you really want to understand what the prevalence of guns means to gun violence in this country, you'll look at individual statistics, right? People that use guns to commit suicide, or people that use guns in crime situations. Is that the point?
Well, that indeed is a key part of the point. Over 30,000 people are killed each year through gun violence, and that includes murders, suicides, and fatal gun accidents. And the overwhelming majority of them are not mass shootings. They are, you know, interpersonal violence. It's a suicidal teenager who gets a hold of a gun. And indeed, there are roughly twice as many gun suicides each year as there are gun homicides. So in many ways, the gun suicide problem is even a bigger problem than gun homicide, although obviously it's all a problem, and it all certainly needs to be addressed by our lawmakers and government officials.
Robert, always appreciative of your insight and your experience with this. Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Robert Spitzer is chair of the Political Science Department at SUNY Cortland, and he is the author of Guns Across America. More coverage of what's happening this morning in Maryland on All Things Considered.